The number of young people in Florida dying from COVID has been on the rise. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. It was believed that mostly elderly were dying of the pandemic, but a New York Times report shows that in the past few months, the median age of COVID victims has skewed younger. And in many cases, it's not that young people are being reckless. Also,
our economic recovery now for our community is probably the most important issue that the next mayor is going to have to deal with.
Miami-Dade Commissioner Esteban Bobo is one of two candidates running for county mayor. We'll hear more from him about his platform. And finally, Florida's economy is in shambles as the governor discusses reopening more businesses. How will our economy have to evolve so that we're not so dependent on tourism and we're better able to respond to the pandemic? All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us today. State officials have said that Florida's coronavirus crisis is largely limited to affecting the elderly, citing their age, weaker immune systems, and pre-existing conditions. But new data reviewed by the New York Times tells us that's changing. More people under 65 years old died in July than people over the age of 90. And more people 25 to 44 years old died in that month compared to the previous 4 months of the pandemic combined. Joining us now is New York Times investigative reporter Danielle Ivory. Danielle, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So you spoke with families who lost loved ones at a young age, and the story profiles workers at nursing homes, even at a McDonald's. Tell us about some of their experiences and what the families were going through.
Right. Well, I and some of my colleagues who worked on the story talked to families who had lost loved ones who were in their 30s, in their 40s. My colleague Frankie Robles talked to the family of Robert Ruiz, as in Sebring, Florida. He was only 31 when he died. He had worked at a center for people with traumatic brain injuries and ended up catching coronavirus from one of the patients. And just 2 days after he started experiencing symptoms, he died in his bedroom. Frenchie talked to sister, and he was just devastated by this. He was only 31 years old.
More than 80% of the coronavirus deaths in Florida are attributed to residents over the age of 65, but there were some alarming numbers in July for young people. What did you find?
Well, so we analyzed Florida death records. Florida actually gave us all of its medical examiner records going back to the beginning of the pandemic. So they're actually very, very good records, and they're up to date. And so we analyzed those records and looked at Floridians that were in the 25 to 44 age range. And although they still make up a relatively small share of coronavirus deaths, they're still at a lower risk than older people and very elderly people. More of the people in that age group died in July than had died in the previous 4 months of the pandemic combined. And we're seeing also on a national level that we've had about 4,000 people in the U.S. in that age range die from the coronavirus. And that would make coronavirus one of the leading causes of death for that age group. It's roughly comparable to the number of people who have been murdered in that same time period over the last, several years. So it's a very serious thing for young people.
Is the COVID-19 positivity rate rising in this age group of young people, as you pointed out?
I don't know that the positivity rate is rising. I mean, I should be very, very clear that the positivity rate for young people is still very low. What's happening is that more young people are getting sick. And it's a little bit of an obvious thing, but the more young people who get sick, the more we're going to see young people die. And anytime you see people dying in this age range, it is a thing.
So how does it, yeah, how does that affect the overall death count in the U.S. when we talk about age demographics?
Well, we're seeing more and more deaths of young people. You know, one of the reasons why we looked at Florida in particular is because Florida's records are so good. We really wanted to do this on a national scale, but it's very, very difficult to get good death records that break this down by demographics in other states. And the CDC does have this data, but it lags by about a month and a half. So at the time when we were doing this article, that was basically missing the surge that we saw in July and now.
What are some of the other factors that are showing up in the figures that you found when it comes to young folks who are dying of the virus? What are the things that point to us why they are?
To why they are? Well, so, you know, we've been seeing a lot on the news, I'm sure you've been seeing this as well, that people are very worried about young people being overly reckless and going back to their regular social activities without any sort of care about catching this virus, with the idea that they're not immune, but they are less likely to have serious problems or die. And certainly that is happening. People are going to parties and bars. We've been seeing on college campuses that coronavirus cases have been tied to rush at frats and sororities. But we're also seeing and maybe, you know, remembering that there were a lot of people in this age range that are considered to be critical workers who are working every day in jobs where they have lots of interaction with the public and don't have the ability to work from home and maybe don't have the ability to stay home when they're feeling sick. So there are a lot of people in this age range that are also just more vulnerable as well. Something else that we saw in our data is that the racial gap between young people who are dying in Florida was tremendous. I mean, surprisingly so.
Yeah, and I want to talk about race here in a second. But again, this is an interesting point that you brought up in your story, is the fact that, yeah, we tend to hear this idea of, well, young people are being reckless. We do hear the stories of young people on college campuses having parties, not social distancing, not wearing their masks. But as you point out in your story, no, it's not always the case. A lot of times it's just young people, again, getting it at work, you know, because they have to work and they can't work from home all the time. They are getting it at work or in other situations. They don't have a choice. Again, I'm talking with New York Times investigative reporter Danielle Ivory. Hundreds of Floridians between the age of 25 and 44 have died from the coronavirus since the pandemic began. And again, this report shows a little bit of what we're seeing. Why is that happening? You could read the New York Times investigation on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's get into, Danielle, the issue of race and the role that race has played in the rise of deaths, because we have always pointed out that the number of COVID cases and deaths amongst Black and Latinos much higher than with whites.
Right. So when we looked at these death records in Florida, we found that younger people who are dying from coronavirus were very disproportionately Black. Black Floridians over the age of 65 are dying at about twice the rate of white residents in Florida. And for younger adults, the death rate is nearly three times as high. We talked to several Florida-based epidemiologists about this, and they thought that this was probably exposing long-existing health inequities between these racial groups, and that young people might be actually experiencing more health problems if they were Black rather than if they were white. So we had one epidemiologist, for example, who said that, you know, basically you have this double impact of minorities being more likely to contract COVID because of long-existing health inequities, and then more likely to die because of the higher likelihood of chronic conditions.
What did you hear from friends and family, you know, again, of this younger group, this younger demographic who died from the virus? What are some of the stories that you found that were in common with each other?
Well, I mean, across the board, families were really, really upset this has happened. We had heard some stories from families about how their, you know, their loved one didn't really think that they could be affected. That was one theme that we heard. But mostly it was just, they just couldn't believe that this had happened, that they had died so young. I mentioned Mr. Ruiz when we began talking. You know, he was someone who he was overweight, but otherwise had no underlying medical conditions. And he was actually, you know, in the process of trying to slim down. He was going to the gym. He perished within 2 days of developing symptoms, and he left behind a toddler.
Yeah, again, as you pointed out, he was, I mean, from what the story told us, he seemed like he was a normal guy. He was a heavy gentleman, but he was a very big man, but he didn't have any issues before that. But that is something that we always keep hearing, too, again, is that if you have pre-existing conditions or if you are overweight or you have diabetes, that that also puts you at greater risk. You spoke with doctors and epidemiologists. What do they say about the long-term effects for young people? What do we know that if you get the virus, but you survive, what you might face the rest of your life? Do they know?
I mean, frankly, the epidemiologist that I talked to, and I talked to a lot of epidemiologists for this story, said that they were really worried about that in particular because there isn't as much information out there and not as good tracking about the kind of symptoms and long-term effects that young people are feeling from this virus. So we have this sort of like black and white situation where it's either you catch it and you die or you don't die. But actually in reality, if you catch coronavirus, you might not die, but you might end up having very serious health problems for perhaps the rest of your life. And that's not being done very well.
So at a press conference at the end of June, Governor Ron DeSantis shared his thoughts on the rise in COVID-19 cases among the younger demographics, is what he said.
Those were situations in which, caution, I think, was thrown to the wind. A lot of the testing, when you find the young people, it's like they go to parties and then some of them do go to some of these establishments. So, you know, we want to minimize that. I think that will be very helpful for us.
So we hear this again, you know, young people aren't taking the virus seriously. And I'm just wondering, like, did you get that sense that younger people just didn't take it serious?
I mean, there is some of that. I don't want to say that all young people are taking this seriously. There are definitely young people who are not taking this. There are older people who are not taking this seriously as well. But I think that young people are being painted with a fairly broad brush right now. There is this sort of thought in the air that young people are being reckless, going to parties, sometimes going to parties where the idea is that you want to catch coronavirus so you can like get it out of the way. That is happening. But when we look through those death records, I mean, we saw example after example of people who probably did not catch this at a party, who either caught it at work because they worked in a health setting, like at a nursing home, or in a traumatic brain injury center like Mr. Ruiz. We had another gentleman who worked at McDonald's. There were a lot of people who were not going out to like a frat party.
Right.
But they were interacting with the public on a daily basis.
Yeah. And you mentioned frat parties. I have to bring this up because you also worked on a story about how colleges and universities are operating during this time. And we've seen several outbreaks around the country and here in Florida, here in Miami, at the University of Miami. What are you seeing? What's going on?
Sure. So I'm on a team at the New York Times that's tracking. We track every case of the coronavirus down to the county level. And then we're also going beyond that to track local clusters as well. One of the things that we're tracking is cases that are showing up on college campuses. I think the last number that we published was more than 17,000 cases at colleges across the United States. We We've reached out to about 1,500 colleges, which includes all four-year public schools, all schools with teams that compete in the NCAA, all colleges that are part of the Association of American Universities, among others that we have been able to confirm cases at. The cases seem to be increasing very rapidly across the country when it comes to college campuses.
You know, and again, as we pointed out here in South Florida, the University of Miami also with a series of cases, positive cases coming out. How are the universities enforcing policies? How are they policing this? What are they saying about trying to keep it under control?
I mean, I think it's incredibly difficult to police these sort of policies. We're hearing from both sides. So we're hearing from people who are saying that it's very difficult for colleges to actually enforce policies where kids have to stay in their rooms. They can't wander the hallways. We're also hearing from parents who are saying that colleges they're becoming like prisons because their kids can't go outside of their room. Dealing with horrible isolation. It's just a really bad situation on both ends.
Yeah. Again, talking with the New York Times investigative reporter Danielle Ivory. You could read their investigation on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Again, looking at how, you know, the number of cases, the number of people testing positive, and the number of deaths amongst younger people is going up in the state of Florida, and you could see why. Danielle, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, still to come, Miami-Dade County is at a crossroads. Will our next leader be a progressive or a conservative? We're going to hear from Commissioner Esteban Bovo. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami-Dade voters have two very different choices to become the next mayor. County Commissioners Esteban Bovo and Daniela Levine Cava secured the highest number of votes in the August primary, and they will face each other in the November election. The nonpartisan position has become highly politicized as Cava has come out as the progressive choice and Bovo as the conservative one. We spoke with Cava last week on the program, and you can hear that interview at WLRN.org. But we spoke with Bovo yesterday. That conversation, unfortunately, was covered by President Trump's nomination at the RNC. Now, you can hear the full interview online where we also talked to him about the role of the county's census counting efforts. But here's an edited portion focused on his political platform.
My platform from day one when I announced my candidacy in October is that I wanted to make sure that county government was responsive to the taxpayer, to the homeowner, the business owner, the people that basically fund our county government through their property taxes. And I wanted to make it accountable. I wanted to make sure that the services that they expect, the core services that they expect, are not only being fulfilled, but they're being delivered in the best possible way. And that I was concerned that for the last couple of years, it seemed that our county was drifting into areas where we were trying to be everything to everybody in our community. And I think there's a great role for the state and the federal government. Not sure, though, if the local government, what is designed for, which is to provide you police, fire, pick up your garbage, fix your streets, are we doing a good enough job there because we're stretching our dollars so much?
How closely are you aligning yourself with the president on policies for this election?
I don't know of instance where the president would be picking up our garbage if it didn't get picked up, or would be fixing the road if there was a pothole. You know, the national scene is a national scene, and the president and his counterpart in Joe Biden are going to try to set an agenda for the national scene. But local government has a unique role that speaks to providing direct services. So when people want police at their home, heaven forbid, on an emergency call, they want the police there within 2 or 3 minutes, if not sooner. Same thing with a fire. And, you know, when you flush your toilet, you want to make sure it's gone. And to me, that's the services that we in county government play. The fact that I'm conservative should have nothing to do with it. You know,
and no,
role
right.
That we play is, I'm sorry, the role that we play, quite honestly, measures dollars that come into our county coffers, which are not red or blue, they're green, and we need to make sure that that service is provided.
What about when you have issues, for example, let's say like social justice issues, when it comes to police reform, and the president starts talking about that, I mean, that's something that will impact you as well. I mean, at any point, you usually don't see mayoral races linked to presidential runs, that's true, but, you know, do you ever see a situation where you would?
Well, there may be instances that the president may take a position that I'm opposed to or that I may agree with. You know, when we deal with issues of social justice, I think our county is an outlier when you talk about other communities. I mean, we've gone through a lot of different growth issues, growing pains, if you will, on the issues of social justice. I would think that our county government, in fact, I know our county government does everything possible to be as inclusive as it can in every realm, whether it is the way we dole out procurements, giving availability to those that could try to get contracts at our county, and our hiring practices. You know, I get a conversation that's being basically flushed out at the national level, and I understand it completely. But I also think that when we talk about Miami-Dade County, we should take it the way we do things in Miami-Dade County. And, you know, we're not Minneapolis.
Right, no.
We shouldn't be compared to Minneapolis.
Let's take a look at those issues then. Miami-Dade right now going through some crisis. We got the health pandemic crisis. We've got the economic shutdown because of the pandemic. There is criminal justice reform on the table. If you're elected in November, where's your greatest priority?
Well, I think it's economic recovery, right? I mean, we have issues in our county that are paramount. Probably would have been the staple of our conversation if it not for COVID, which is transportation, housing, environmental issues. I mean, we got a travesty going on in Key Biscayne that requires attention, and I think it requires attention that is a smart way of, and not just throwing money at it. But I would tell you that our economic recovery now for our community is probably the most important issue that the next mayor is going to have to deal with. Are we doing enough testing? Are we doing enough tracking? Are we doing enough to help businesses stay open, you know, in the right way where they're protecting their employees and they're also protecting their clients? I think to me, that's going to be the biggest challenge in the interim time that the new mayor takes hold of office, until we get to a situation where either we have a vaccine or you know, the virus is already secondhand and we're no longer dealing with it. But yeah, that has to be, I think, the most important issue that the next mayor will be confronted with.
Again, I'm talking with Miami-Dade County Commissioner Esteban Bovo. Bovo and fellow Commissioner Daniela Levine-Cava will face off in a runoff in November, the general election, to be the next mayor of Miami-Dade County. You can find more information about the results from the August primaries. Go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Let's say that you win and we get into the wintertime and there's another wave of COVID, because we keep hearing from the health experts, they're afraid of that happening. How would you play this out differently than how Mayor Carlos Jimenez has, you know, when it comes to shutdowns and quarantining? What would you do?
Well, look, and, you know, I've always hesitate with these kind of things because it's always playing Monday morning quarterback into a pandemic that there was no playbook on. But I would tell you if I had an opportunity.
But did we learn? But what did you learn from this one if it happens again?
Yeah, well, there are lessons learned, I was going to say. And what have we learned is that, number one, you have to have better communications with your municipalities. I think part of the problem we've had, and this really the ones that were paying the consequences were the residents of Miami-Dade County, was that you had failure of the mayor communicating with other mayors and back and forth. I'm not blaming anybody, but I would tell you the fundamental lack of communication created so much confusion amongst residents. Curfew, no curfew, businesses opening, to what time, what businesses are open. I mean, this has to be done in a more uniform fashion. And I would tell you, elected mayor, I would be on the phone with all the mayors of all the different cities to get us all on the same page and understand that we all have a goal. We want a healthy community, no doubt, and we also don't want to punish business owners that were trying or are doing the things in the right way and punish them by keeping them open. We've seen businesses closed now that'll never be reopened, and that you know, we have to also take into account small businesses and the sacrifice that many go through just to open their business and sustain their business.
So do you think that we can have another shutdown like we did?
I don't know if we could afford it, to be perfectly honest with you. I think what we should be working toward right now is enforcing the rules and regulations as far as mask wearing is concerned, social distancing. But, you know, look, I'm still at odds, perhaps with the administration and others, that when we shut down on this second wave, we were punishing businesses for what I thought was irresponsible behavior of others. I didn't see the business community acting irresponsibly. You walked into a restaurant, there was plexiglass, there was social distancing, mask wearing by the staff, sanitation or sanitizing equipment there and what have you. To me, the mistake perhaps was that you had a lot of young people figuring, I'm immune, I'm not in any danger, let's go out and enjoy our lives the way we've always had. And you also had about a 3-week, 4-week spike of people demonstrating where there was no social distancing. And I think we were kind of product of something that, as government did it the best it could to kind of tamper down, now we were reacting. I think we need to, again, better communication, better information. We need to consult with small business, not the big folks. I mean, the big businesses seem to be okay. It's that small mom and pop that I know goes through. I was raised in a mom and pop, so I know what the diagram is like. You know, it's mom, dad, you know, brother and sister, aunts and uncles all working in a business. And then you wipe them out. I mean, it's hard to recover from that.
And you keep referring to, because I just want to point out again, is one of the challenges that we saw was that you had the county doing something and different cities, different municipalities were doing something else sometimes.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
You know what? I mean, I wanted to come back to this idea. Miami-Dade County has been a Democratic stronghold for years, voted big for Hillary Clinton over President Trump. But what's the strategy for you in winning over those independents, getting the Republican base excited, winning over a few of those extra people? Is anything going to change for these next few months?
Look, like I said earlier, my campaign was really based upon the homeowner and business owners and making sure that regulations and taxing was not being overburdened on them, making sure that we responded in different ways. I could never imagine that we were going to go through a pandemic when I announced my campaign in October. I could never imagine that we were going to go through situations of social injustice or police brutality in Minneapolis and how it would have, that repercussion would be felt here, where this conversation of defunding police, which I think by now everybody understands or signs off, it's kind of crazy talk. But these things, quite honestly, not that I was ahead of the curve, but I steadfastly said right off the bat, we're not defunding police. And I think that kind of moved people in my direction because they don't want their community to be another New York or Chicago or Portland for that matter. I don't know if my message changes. I mean, look, I don't hide the fact that I'm a Republican. But to be perfectly honest with you, like I said, your dollars, you and I as homeowners, when we pay our taxes, you know, they go into an account and it doesn't say Democrat or Republican. And when we dole out our services as county, it doesn't say we'll give it to certain Democrat areas or Republican areas. We have to be across the board to provide service. People come into my office, they don't even tell you if they're registered to vote. You got to give service, and that's what we do.
That was Miami-Dade County Commissioner Esteban Bovo. You can hear our full interview with him, as well as our conversation last week with Daniela Levine-Cava at WLRN.org. Well, still to come, Florida's economy has always been dependent on tourism. Will COVID-19 change that part of our identity? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, the latest job numbers show that Florida has a long recovery ahead. 11% of Floridians remain out of work. What job opportunities will be created for those who've lost work because of this pandemic? How will our economy evolve? Urbanist and researcher Richard Florida has thought a lot about those questions. He's a professor at the University of Toronto's School of Cities and Rotman School of Management. But he spent a lot of time here researching in South Florida. He published a series of reports for the Brookings Institute about how cities' economies will need to change because of COVID-19. And he joins us now. Richard, great to have you back.
It's always great to be back with you.
So tell me, Richard, why is South Florida's economy so vulnerable to this pandemic?
Well, I mean, if you looked at the last unemployment figures, the Miami area had nearly 14% unemployment, which is about the highest rate of unemployment it's had in a long, long time, much higher than the catastrophic 2008 economic and financial crisis. But the nature of the region's economy, if we look either at Miami-Dade County or we look at the metro area, which spans Miami-Dade County, Broward County, and Palm Beach County, the Tri-County area, Miami ranks first in the country. This is just striking to me. Of all large metros with a highly vulnerable workforce, and by vulnerable workforce, that's a workforce that's at risk from getting COVID. People who have a high degree of interaction with the public and a high degree of interaction with other workers. And according to another report, a Brookings industry report, the nature of our economy in South Florida puts a huge number of jobs at risk in the future. They're estimating about 500,000 jobs could be at risk, a fifth of all jobs, which leaves it the eighth most vulnerable. And I think in general, what we're finding is that economies that have a lot of knowledge jobs and professional jobs, what I call creative class jobs in finance, business, technology, even arts and culture, they tend to be more protected. Their workers tend to be more protected. They can work remotely, and the economies tend to be more protected. But economies like South Florida, which are heavily dependent on hospitality and tourism and have a lot of frontline workers, they're much more vulnerable. So we've been hit hard by the pandemic, and the economic fallout is also quite far reaching.
And we have a lot of service jobs, you know, that basically. So, but you know what? I mean, looking at how things continue to worsen, they're starting to get a little bit better. I mean, if we look at the numbers, but what's the biggest concern about how this economy, this area, is going to rebuild? How are we going to do this?
Well, first, just to note your point about service workers. Over half of the Miami metropolitan workforce is comprised of low-paid service workers, frontline workers. Those people are by definition making low wages. Our estimate is they take home about $26,500 a year, and when you put housing costs into the calculation, it's a meager sum. That's about less than half. That's less than half of what professional workers in the region. And you know, the region, by the way, is the second most unequal region in the metropolitan area in the country. So what do we need to do? I think we got to get really serious. And I've not seen this happening. I want to be really candid about this. It's something that's quite frustrating, not just to me, but to many others. I think in general, most regions of the country have been playing catch up. You know, we just heard about it. First, we tried to do a lockdown and that doesn't work. And then we thought about we'd reopen, and we reopened quite, I don't want to even call it carelessly, but haphazardly. Cases went up, deaths went up. We've never thought strategically. And I think the biggest thing is that right now, Miami and South Florida, but all American communities, are failing to think strategically about economic recovery. Think about this. This is like a giant natural disaster, like a hurricane, which has hit the entire country. And we not only need to plan about how to get back on our feet, but how to recover. And we failed to do that. And I think, you know, we can go into this in more depth if you want, but I think it means really repositioning our economy from a tourism and hospitality and real estate economy that's based on deal making to a real knowledge economy that's based on some stable economic sectors, startups, finance, headquarters, knowledge-based businesses. And that's a big lift for our region, because it's a big change.
Yeah, hold on. Am I hearing you right then? I mean, look, right now we're trying to figure out how to get to phase two, you know, in South Florida, the reopening, which is having more businesses reopen. But are you saying that this is a time when we have to start thinking maybe we got to change our identity?
Well, think about the conversation that we're having in the region. How do we get restaurants back open? How do we get bars back open? How do we get hotels back open? Is that an economy? It's not.
That's the economy we've had, though.
Exactly. And so we need to be thinking, of course, about how to do that safely. But we need to build a real economy. And, you know, there's such an opportunity. You hear this every day. High net worth New Yorkers are moving to Miami. Luxury home sales are at a record high. People favor Miami because of its weather, its climate, and the fact that taxes are low in South Florida. I mean, this is like a mantra. Well, let's take that trend of people saying we'd like to live in, and those people are not really working in South Florida. Some of them may be living in South Florida, some permanently, some for whatever, 6 months at a time or less. But they're working businesses that are headquartered in other regions. We have developed a great relationship with the New York metropolitan area as a place that people live and sometimes commute to work. And we have a spectacular relationship as the headquarters of South and Latin America. Let's take that up. And we have a budding startup sector that's done really well.
Okay.
Let's take that opportunity to build a real economy.
So let me see. How do we do that? So let me start with this. I mean, again, we have so many service jobs, so many businesses that cater to that, to the tourists. I mean, where do we begin? Because, you know, it's saying to the business owner, yeah, we're not reopening your bar or your nightclub because we need to start a different type of business. And then you get all those workers who don't have the training or education.
So I think it's a two-step plan to boil it down. First, as we recover and we provide assistance, and we just heard from the previous caller, the small mom and pops need financial assistance and they need technical assistance. Let's create technical assistance SWAT teams for a healthy and safe reopening, but also to change the business model. We know, because of great research that's been done by a wide variety of people, that when small businesses, and particularly large tourism and hospitality businesses, implement a good job strategy, paying their workers more, engaging them more, and supporting them better, not only do workers do better and have a higher wage, the company does better. The second prong of the strategy has to be now to put in place a real plan for a better and more resilient economy for South Florida. People aren't doing that. You know, people always talk about the regional collaboration that came about as a part of the Amazon HQ2 effort to lure Amazon. We didn't get the headquarters, but we can build upon that to say, how do we build a more of a knowledge-based economy? How do we use the investments and the talent that's coming our way to reposition our economy? Of course, we're going to be tourism and hospitality, but we need to be tourism, hospitality, and real estate plus a knowledge economy.
And by the way, you said something that I haven't heard before. Technical SWAT team, is that what you said?
Yeah, I think we should have technical SWAT teams that are comprised of healthcare and infectious disease specialists, but also business model specialists that can go in and work with these smaller businesses in tourism, in hospitality, in arts and culture, small retail shops, and help them realign their not only their health and safety protocols, but to realign their business models. I mean, a lot of this will be, we're lucky. It's a warm climate. People can be outside a lot of the year. A lot of services can be provided outside. Some of these businesses can provide personalized services, hair salons. All of these services, massage, therapy, physical fitness, can be brought to the customer. If we just provided a little help, you know, taking business school students and maybe medical school students, developing these SWAT teams, it could help a lot of our businesses, you know, deal with this crisis more effectively.
And the other thing, too, is this. I'm curious if you've ever seen a city comparable to Miami that's done that anywhere in the world where they actually shifted and became something very different?
Yes. I mean, there's lots of examples of that. I lived in Pittsburgh for nearly 20 years, and it took a lot of hard labor and a lot of hard thinking, but Pittsburgh went from an iron and steel and heavy industry economy to one of the leading centers of artificial intelligence and self-driving cars and a leading knowledge economy. We're working right now in Bentonville, Arkansas, supported by the Walton Family Foundation, to develop a regional recovery strategy for the Bentonville-Fayetteville metropolitan area. And they are investing a lot of money into thinking about how to make that economy a different kind of economy. Tulsa, Oklahoma, developed a remarkable remote worker strategy. What about South Florida? Would be a place that could draw remote workers by the drove. But Tulsa, Oklahoma has put up a small grant and it attracts remote workers and builds a peer community. So yeah, I think that Miami is actually, South Florida, very much poised to do this if we just put our, you know, shoulder to the grindstone.
Again, talking with urbanist Richard Florida, discussing the impact of COVID-19 on South Florida's economy and how our economy has to evolve after this. And you can find some of Richard's stories, by the way, in research on our social media at WLRN Sundial. I mean, those are some interesting examples, Richard. I knew about Pittsburgh. I just wonder, though, because our housing costs are so high here. And you mentioned housing. So let's talk about that for a second here. South Florida is still among the most rent burdened in the country. 6 in 10 adults spending a third or more of their income on rent. How do you think the pandemic will exacerbate the housing crisis here?
You know, I think we have a short-term opportunity to reset our housing market. It's clear that in our metro across the country, there's going to be less demand for office towers, and there's going to be less demand for retail space, and there's probably going to be less demand for luxury condominium. So all three of those things give us an opportunity to begin to transition some of our office markets, some of our retail, not just in the city, you know, old abandoned malls, old abandoned shopping centers, and some of that luxury product, at least begin to think about how to create more affordable housing. But yes, I mean, those are our statistics. 6 in 10 employed adults in Miami, in the Miami metro, are housing cost burdened. That's the highest rate of any large metro in the country. So housing affordability is partly it's a housing cost issue. The other part of it is we just don't pay people well. We have a high poverty rate. We have a high unemployment rate. We have low wages. So at the same time, we should be looking at strategies to boost the wages and jobs by improving those frontline service jobs and paying people more.
You know, you look at the current situation right now, the state of Florida does have a moratorium on evictions, though we are now seeing evictions being processed in Miami-Dade County. If that moratorium is lifted, do you think South Florida could be on the verge of a housing crisis?
I think we're in the middle of a housing crisis. I think that South Florida is really, you know, people talk about a tale of two cities. Boy, oh boy, you have sort of the richest people in the Americas, you know, across the board. And you have poor people, you know, just desperately poor people and low-paid service workers. So yeah, and I think what's so important is that we begin to work on this as a region. You know, you're not going to solve these problems overnight, but we need to really pay detailed attention to them. And we need to be paying real attention about how to rebuild our economy. You know, Joe Biden, build back better, those three words. How do we rebuild this South Florida economy in a way that's more inclusive, that's less exclusive, that has a focus on raising the bottom, not just lifting the top? That isn't just a luxury destination for high net worth people. And we have an opportunity to do that. I think, you know, you've been talking about this with the Black Lives Matter protests, with the focus on racial and economic inequity, and the need to be a more just and inclusive nation, more just and inclusive cities. Folks are telling us, they're raising their voices and saying we need to focus on this and do it. And I think our recovery strategy needs to build a stronger economy, but also a more inclusive and resilient economy.
And you talk about that, and you'd mentioned, you know, the startups. And look, we've always been a really hot place for this, for the startups. And we talked last week with the head of the Beacon Council, who explained how companies now are transitioning to meet the needs of the pandemic, you know, and shifting what the startup ideas are. How does South Florida continue to be an attractive place for these new companies, and maybe even more so, steal some away from the West Coast and bring them here?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. We obviously have two things in addition to hospitality and tourism that are quite striking. We have a world-class medical community throughout the region. And a focus on health and lifestyle. And we've created some very interesting health and lifestyle businesses. We also have a real estate and architecture industry, which is, you know, quite good. And we could almost think about creating this whole new sector. So I call it urban tech, this fusion of smart cities, property technology, construction technology, new methods of architecture. And we could fuse that with building a more resilient community. I mean, we are ground zero for climate change. We need to take that into account. So what if we began to really look at South Florida as a laboratory, not only for building communities that are more resilient to climate change, but are more resilient and healthier? That could be, I really believe this area, which I dubbed urban tech, is the biggest area of startup technology that we've ever seen. It's bigger than biotechnology. It's bigger than artificial intelligence. It's bigger than software technology. It's about a fifth to a quarter of all venture capital investment globally today. Miami would have a real shot at also mobility, you know, self-driving cars. There's a number of self-driving car operations already in South Florida because of the weather and the sunshine, good road conditions. So all of those things could help us develop not only a new technology sector, but a way to develop our community in a way that's more inclusive and more resilient.
But hasn't one of the challenges always been, too, with these startups, these tech startups? They're small. They tend to be small. They hire a few people.
I think yeah, but you need to think about things that'll make your economy more resilient. So you want great big companies. You want really great anchor institutions like medical centers and universities that are engaged, and ARSC should be engaged more. You want a diverse group of small businesses, and you want high-tech startups, and you want remote workers. When you put all those things together, you tend to get a much more resilient economy. And I think the biggest thing facing us is that we remain a very deal-driven place, which is, I mean, I understand where it comes from. It's the history of Miami and South Florida. We don't think ahead. And one of the things, if we began to think ahead and do what folks do in the San Francisco Bay Area or greater New York or greater Boston or even Toronto, where I spend half of the year, and began to think ahead and developed a strategy. It doesn't have to be a detailed plan, a shared strategy for the way to rebuild our economy. We would begin to focus on doing it. And I think that's what we don't do enough of. We just think, take things as they can. Maybe we've done that for a long time. We need to be proactive in thinking about how we want to rebuild our economy, both to be a stronger and more vibrant economy, but also, and really importantly, to be a more inclusive and just economy with regard to race and class.
And, you know, another big thing, there's so many things to cover, but I want to get to one more here, is the arts. Hit really hard by this, theaters, galleries, museums, everybody. There is legislation in Congress now to try to fund independent venues. It's called Save Our Stages, but that's just a stopgap. In the Brookings report, you suggest this is an opportunity for us to invest in locally sourced culture. What do you mean?
Well, I'm terrified. I mean, if you ask me the thing that really terrifies me about this pandemic, outside of mass unemployment and the tragedy of race and class and service workers, our arts and cultural system is being decimated. And, you know, we have 120,000 artistic organizations and nonprofits, many of whom are failing already. I think, you know, we're not going to have big concert tours for a while. You know, no big Rolling Stones or U2, Bruce Springsteen, Taylor Swift, Justin Bieber, The Weeknd, Drake shows, DJ Khaled. But, you know, in a place like South Florida where the weather is nice, you could have locally sourced culture in every neighborhood. We could create markets and opportunities for people to do block parties, socially distanced and safe with the requisite number of people. Hire a local performer, hire a local musician. We work with a company in Miami called Reef Technology that's aggregated a bunch of parking lots. We've been talking with that company, headquartered in Miami, about using parking lots, not only as places to stage restaurants or allow restaurants to expand, but as places that can become community hubs. You could imagine these block parties, if you will. I forget the community in Europe that says it wants to become the community of all day, you know, 24/7 music and the arts on every corner. Boy, with our weather and climate, Greater Miami can become that city, a city of art, and not just a city of arts and culture that's animated during Art Basel, but arts and culture and musical performance and small-scale theatrical performance that's in every neighborhood and every community 365 days a year.
Well, I'm sure there are a lot of people in the arts who would love to hear that, who would love to see that. Let me finish with this. Ideally, what do you think Miami and South Florida, the metro region from Palm Beach County down, is going to look like in 5 years after hopefully the pandemic by then is gone?
If we do nothing and we continue the path we're on, we will rebound and we will become ever more increasingly unstable and unequal. Our economy will be unbalanced, heavily dependent on tourism and hospitality with lots of low-wage jobs. And we will be even more unequal and in many ways unstable, because that's going to provoke very serious backlash. But if we're smart and we begin to think long and hard about this recovery, and I just want to say this, not only in the Miami metro, but if we hook up with Orlando, with Disney and the Space Coast, with Tampa, that's a mega region, you know, that's as big an economy as Sweden or the Netherlands. If we're really strategic about this, yeah, we can start to build a great knowledge-based economy. And if we're really smart, we'll do that with an eye to inclusivity, to racial and economic equity, and to resilience. Hopefully in 5 years, you know, I'm being realistic, we can start that conversation and be on the track. I don't think we'll solve all these problems. But if I had to look forward to 5 years, we'd be beginning to have a more robust conversation on the way to dealing with these problems, building a better, more inclusive and resilient economy for all South Floridians.
It's an interesting position. We think about our identity and what we've been for so long. And, you know, is it going to be a pandemic that makes us change, that we can become a stronger economy, a stronger region? A really interesting conversation. And we've got plenty of time to think about this and talk about it. Again, Richard Florida, urbanist and researcher from the University of Toronto School of Cities and Rotman School of Management. Richard, always a pleasure. Love talking to you.
Thank you. Talk again soon.
All right.
Stay safe.
Stay safe, definitely. And that's our program for this Tuesday, August 25th. What do you think about that? How should South Florida change? Well, coming up tomorrow on the program, we meet two new school board members in Broward and Palm Beach counties. They're also the two youngest members on their school boards. One is 27, one is 30. We'll hear why they ran for office and some of the key issues. Plus, we want to hear from you. If your child is in school in Palm Beach or Broward, what are you hoping for this upcoming school year? Plus, thousands of graduates at Florida law schools are waiting to take the bar exam. The state has changed the date multiple times now, leaving many in limbo that want to get out there and start practicing. There's a petition now to let graduates just start without the bar. And we'll hear from a student and a reporter following the story. And finally, this month, we've been reading Black Widow by Leslie Gray Streeter. The memoir details Leslie's experience losing her husband and raising a child on her own. While many of us are dealing with pain during this pandemic, we'll hear from a grief counselor about tips for those in need. And by the way, you can always join the Sundial Book Club. Just go to Facebook and look up Sundial Book Club. It's free. We'd love to have you. This week, we're going to announce next month's Sundial Book Club selection. Hope you've been enjoying this month's book. I'm Luis Hernandez. As always, stay safe. Thanks again for listening. We'll talk to you live tomorrow.